Let's do the serenity prayer again because I need it. Trust me. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. So it was pretty, I have to say, it was pretty funny when my dear friend in Denver, Mike, and I held a retreat, Relationships and Recovery, but we didn't tell anybody it was on the traditions, and everybody was so mad at us. And Mike said, "Oh, that's okay. We'll just make amends now." But it was really fun. So I tend to incorporate a lot of the traditions in my talks simply because they have changed my life as well. But we'll get into that more later. If people don't mind, if I could have a show of hands, are there any newcomers here tonight? Welcome. And is there anyone here in OA for like the first 30 days? Or first 60 days? How about your first year? Welcome. I have to say, it takes a lot of guts, especially when you're brand new, to come to an OA retreat. Let me tell you a little bit about myself. And someone, please give me like the timeout or, you know, get the hook out, drag me off stage, because I'll just keep rattling on. You guys will be going, "Somebody please shut her up." Anyway, so let me qualify. I'm Tana. I'm a compulsive overeater, and I call myself a recovering ABC, anorexic, bulimic, compulsive overeater. The anorexic part is, you know, if you're familiar with the term font, in like, it's like a four-point font, you know, tiny bit of anorexia, an eight-point font, bulimia. And that's kind of what got me into these rooms. And then a 1,000-point font, something that would be bigger than the building, compulsive overeater. So I'm, you know, even though I have a multifaceted disease, I have sampled all of it at one point. I've been in program over 29 years now. I have 25 years of sobriety with the food, abstinence from compulsive overeating. I have 29 years of abstinence from bulimia. That was being, I was a exercise and laxative and diuretic abuser. My weight has varied quite a bit over my food insanity years, anywhere from 115 pounds, which is way beyond six skinny at my height, to 210 pounds. So I've had, my weight has gone a wide variety. But I've seen the gamut. I have, currently I'm about 15 pounds above my goal weight. Menopause has not been kind to me. It really irritates the shit out of me. Anyway, I didn't say that. Sorry. I'm just going to say this. Sorry, guys, you're just going to have to plug your ears. But, you know, I used to think when, you know, women turn 50 and they say, "Well, menopause, blah, 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 blah," I used to think, "Oh, honey, you were in such denial. You were just saddling up the dessert buffet a few too many times. If you just put the fork down," and then I went through it, and it's like, I've never had a muffin top, and all of a sudden it appeared. Holy crap, where did that come from? You know, I mean, it is a real thing, just saying. So I'm not as thin as I'd like to be, but, you know, my doctor keeps saying, she goes, "Just shut up, you're fine. Just get out and exercise more." So I try to trust her. So what it was like before OA. Before I got into OA, I was, in my family, I come from a good German, you know, from a rural farm community, you know, feelings were not allowed unless it was happy. You know, you pull yourself up by your bootstraps. You don't whine. You know, in fact, I have in my kitchen a sign that says there will be a $5 charge for whining. I have brought some of that dysfunction right along with me into my current family with my kids. My parents did the best they could with the tools they had. They really did. I didn't realize this early in recovery. I had a lot of resentment and a lot of hurt. But now looking back, I realize they had an incomplete toolbox. They came with a much smaller toolbox than I was given as a child. And when you don't have a lot of tools, you just try to use what's there. And, you know, if you're trying to get a screw into the wall, a hammer's not the best, you know, device, or a wrench, you know. So, you know, part of my recovery has been gathering tools and replacing broken tools. And so, you know, feelings were not really allowed. You know, being sad, crying, being upset about something, that just was not okay. And so I learned at a very young age, you buried your feelings. And, you know, you just, it's kind of like you stuffed them down. And food was really, really useful. And it was really, you know, it worked quite well. When I was in high school, I went through some hormone troubles, and I had surgery on my ovaries, and they put me in birth control pills. This is when I think of as a sophomore, and to kind of regulate things. Sorry, guys, you're just going to have to plug your ears. Anyway, what happened was these pills did not agree with my system. It wasn't for birth control. It was kind of a regular, you know. Anyway, and I thought it would be kind of cool because, you know, then I could, even though I was, you know, pure as the driven snow, I could feel like a little bit of a bad girl. But anyway, that's another story. Because I had my first boyfriend at the time, too, and we'd done nothing. But at any rate, I gained 40 pounds in 3 months. And it was shocking. I mean, I just went... And it was really... I went off the birth control pills after 3 months because this was just scary. And then the weight, you know, started slowly going down. But this started a 35, 40-pound yo-yo that just went up and down and up and down and up and down until I got into program. And so, but, you know, imagine going through high school. It's like I was really skinny as a freshman. I was always kind of a chunky kid. My freshman year, I lost weight. I decided that 125 pounds, which is really, you know, 15 to 20 pounds too thin for my height anyway, I decided I needed to lose weight. You know, my mom had all the diets on the fridge, and so I thought I needed to lose weight. You know, I lost weight, you know, and then this whole explosion of weight, you know, and then I was back again. I was a chunky kid, but now I had angry purple stretch marks, and it looked like my skin had torn on my legs, on my waist, and, you know, my breast, and it was just, you know, it's bad enough to be chunky, but then to be chunky and have all these nasty stretch marks was just devastating. You know, it really was. And also, you know, so I, you know, it was just that, and I had this terrible cystic acne on my back. And so trying to put on a swimsuit, so I not only did I have, you know, the angry stretch marks, but then I looked like a pizza on my back. So it just was really not, adolescence was really painful for many reasons. And so I just bring that up because, when you're not taught how to deal with things like grief and sadness and seeing my cat when I was 14 be electrocuted on a power pole and fall down, and that was the catalyst that just threw me into the compulsive overeating. That was the catalyst, and I still tear up about it, you know, and that was when I was 14. I'm 56 now, so it's been a while. But it was such a profoundly devastating thing in my life. And food comforted me. Food didn't tell me how to suck it up. Food didn't tell me to pull myself up by the bootstraps. Food comforted me when I had nothing else. And that cat was my confidant. That cat was like, you know, the person I would talk to in the house. You know, I didn't know this as a kid, but I also had ADHD. And I knew I was different, you know, but I didn't know why. You know, when you're 12 years old and you read a, you know, 24-volume set of psychology, pop psychology books to figure out why you're different than everybody else, you know, it was a painful, painful time. So to know I was different but not know why, have my cat die, to gain all this weight, and then find out my boyfriend had been cheating on me, you know, I mean, it's like, you know, it was just kind of a rough time. So again, weight up and down, up and down. So I just kind of give you an idea of what it was like. Then I got to college. Get in a relationship, I would be thin, we'd start getting physical, and then the weight would creep up 35 pounds. And then we'd break up, and the weight would go down 35 pounds. And this yo-yo went up and down. So it was, you know, it was just really, I had a good time. I had way too much fun in college, especially my first 2 years. I hope my kids never find out about all the partying I did. You know, I've got a halo to maintain, you know, and But anyway, well, at some point, I'm sure I'll have the opportunity to share my strength, hope, and experience with them when they go to college. I'm kind of dreading that. But anyway, so here I have an incomplete toolbox. I graduated with my bachelor's degree. I moved to California for my first job. I am in the Bay Area. It is very different than Eastern Washington, Ritzville. You know, where, you know, our long hair don't cover our red neck and cows may walk down the street, you know. And it's just very, very, I mean, there's wonderful things about growing up in a tiny farming community, but it's like everybody knows everybody else and half the town is related. And if they know what you're doing, or if they don't know what you're doing, they talk about it anyway. So, you know, I went to this tiny community to a small state school in northern Idaho, University of Idaho, and then I went to the Bay Area. And that was a huge, huge change. I was in a predominantly male field. I was the only woman engineer in a group of 40 people. The people didn't quite know what to do with me because there weren't many women engineers back then, and they kind of look at me like, what do we do with her now, you know? But I was fortunate because I had some men in the department who were kind of like my grandfather's age who finally figured out if they just treat me like their granddaughter, it was going to be all fine. And so I married my college sweetheart. And right after we were married, during the honeymoon, he became very verbally abusive. And I was just like, oh, my God. And I did not know how to deal with rage. I did not know how to deal with anger. My parents talked about everything. We discussed things, but there was never arguments. And so once again, I started eating. And then I started thinking, well, what's the problem is I have fat thighs. If I just lose weight and have thin thighs, he won't treat me bad. And so then I went on a commercial weight loss plan, and I lost a lot of weight. I became very thin. And you know what? He didn't change his behavior. And I couldn't figure out what I'd done wrong, you know, because it's like, you know, I just kept thinking, if I try harder, he'll be nice to me. He won't yell at me. He won't call me a stupid F and B in the middle of the supermarket because I picked up the wrong can of something. I mean, I just had never experienced this before in my life. Ever. And I didn't know how to deal with it. I didn't know that you could just get divorced and walk away, because in my family, you know, divorce was not an option. Murder, maybe. Divorce, no. You know? So, you know, you work things out. And so it's that thinking, you know, that it's that diet mentality. If I just get thin again, if I get thin, things will be better. And so, I lost all this weight. It didn't change. And then all the feelings started coming up, and then I started purging. I started the laxative abuse. I was definitely compulsively exercising like crazy. It was not good. And I decided, you know, we went into marriage counseling because I told her about my eating disorder, you know, and she said, well, it might be 5 years or more before we get a handle on this. And I thought, I'm going to die. I won't make it that long. Because if the compulsive overeating won't kill you, the depression will. I was horribly depressed. And I tried my best efforts, and it wasn't working. I looked great on the outside, but on the inside, you know, I had a good job. I was married. You know, I was very successful in my career. But on the inside, I was dying. And so a friend of mine, somebody suggested that maybe I should think about OA when I was talking about eating an entire, you know, round circular unit that people get for the birthdays. And I said, but I don't have a problem with food. You know, no denial here. And so then maybe a month or two later, another friend of mine, Gail, said, well, you know, I want to go to an OA meeting, but I don't want to go by myself. Would you come with me? And so being a good flaming codependent with both afterburners going, I said, well, of course I'll go with you. I had rescued Dale, you know. And the first meeting I went to, I just thought, oh, my God. I walked in there, and it's like there was no seats except for kind of closer to the front. And I'm just like, oh, I can't believe this. So I sat down, and it's like they asked you to introduce yourself. So I'm Tana. Hi, Tana. And I'm just thinking, oh, God, this is so weird. It's just cult-like. And then you know, and then they were talking about all this weird crap. And I would be in these meetings and I just think, these people are just strange. You know, why are they airing their dirty laundry, you know, in front of this whole group of people? Don't they know that skeletons belong in the closet? You know, and I just thought, you know, these guys are effed up. And you know, Gail wanted to go back and she didn't want to go alone, and I couldn't, you know, let her go by herself. And so I came back, and by the third meeting, it was like, okay, sign me up. I found my lost tribe. That had been coming back ever since. So that's how I got to OA. You know, when I went to my first OA meeting, they were reading from the big book. And in the big book, they would always read the part in the big book where it says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. you know, those who cannot are not willing to, are not able to give themselves to this, you know, are not able to be rigorously honest and are not incapable of giving themselves to this simple program. And I just kind of butchered the paraphrasing, but you know what I mean. And I really held on to that. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. I knew I could be honest. You know, I knew that, you know, I knew that was a good thing to be, and I was raised in a Christian family. And so, you know, I understood, you know, a lot of morality type stuff. And my parents were not religious per se, but they walked the talk. They didn't talk about it much. They just did it in their lives. And so I came from a really good core value system, which was really good. And so I kept thinking, okay, I'm a good student. 12 steps, 12 weeks, I'm out of here. You know, didn't quite work that way. But I keep, you know, and now I jokingly now say I came for the vanity, but I stayed for the sanity. You know, it's just, you know, for the first 4 years, it was so hard. I was in and out of relapse for 4 years. So people who are having trouble with relapse, it is part of my story. It has not been part of, it's not part of everyone's story. You don't have to have relapse. It's part of my story. It took me 4 years to get clean and sober with the food. And I would do great for 6 days, and on the seventh day, I would just dive into the food. And then I would get 6 months, and then I would dive into the food. And, you know, it was really painful because I got a sponsor within the first month of coming into program, maybe the first 2 months. I got a food sponsor first, and she suggested maybe I want to get a step sponsor. So I got a step sponsor too. And, you know, and it was probably a good thing I had both because I burned people out. I was such a mess, and I was so desperate that I really gave my sponsors a run for their money. Those poor women, you know. So, but, you know, and they would say, you know, I was given this gift of desperation. So they would say jump, and I would say give me a vector, magnitude and direction, how high and in what direction do you want me to jump. And so they'd say, I want you to call 2 people a day, every day, and I'd think, damn it. And then I would do it. And I want you to write on this step, and I want you to read this in the big book. And back in those days, back when dinosaurs roamed the earth, you know, the Precambrian era or whatever, you know, maybe it wasn't that one, but, you know, we didn't have an OA Brown book. We just had the AA 12 and 12 and the AA Big Book, and we had the OA Brown book, and we might have had Lifeline Sampler. I don't remember. We didn't have OA literature like we have now. And so I really had a hard time with the Big Book at first. You know, I went through the entire Big Book, the first 164 pages, and I crossed out alcoholic in each place and put compulsive overeater because I had to be precise about this. We all came into OA with a common problem. You know, all of us come into OA with different issues. We all come in with an incomplete toolbox. We use food as a drug. We eat because we're happy. We eat because we're sad. We've stolen food. An example of you know, my parents were teachers, and so every Christmas we would get these goodie treats, just baskets and baskets of goodie treats from all the students. Both parents were teachers, and all 25 students would bring goodie treats to my parents. And us kids, you know, money was really tight for us, and so, you know, we grew our own vegetables. My dad hunted for meat and fish for fish, and things were always really, really tight money-wise, and so we didn't get a lot of goody treats. So it was like Christmas time. Oh, it was, all of us kids were like, wow, you know, Mecca. So what my mom would do is she would wrap the goody treats in butcher paper and write on the butcher paper, deer liver, because my dad hunted deer and he would butcher them and put, you know. So we'd have freezers full of deer liver, and I finally figured out there was something in those packages. So I would go in the freezer, and I would open every one of those packages up, and I found the ones that were marked deer liver had the treats. So I got into those and ate those. So yeah, you know, eating burned food, eating food of questionable, maybe past their expiration date, sneaking food to our parents, you know, all that kind of stuff I did, hiding food, eating it, and then having to go out and buy and replace it, you know, so people wouldn't know that I ate whatever, you know. I did a lot of baking. I cooked for the family from seventh grade through high school because that way I got to eat what I wanted to eat. And then I got to sample all the time. This was not good for the weight, by the way, or for my compulsive overeating. So, you know, I have again, that's a, kind of how it was like a little bit more. I just realized I needed to bring that up because some of the newer people may not, you have to be able to identify with what the speaker's saying. And, you know, you're in the right place, trust me. So I did many more crazy things, but I won't go into all that yet. So I got into program. I got a sponsor. I started working the steps. I went to at least, well, at first I was going to a meeting a week. And then my sponsor said, well, you may, but, and I was struggling with my food. And she goes, you know, you can go to more than one meeting a week. I said, but isn't that kind of like being disloyal to my home group? I didn't know you'd go to different meetings. And so then I was going to 3 meetings a week. And then my sponsor said, maybe you ought to do 90 meetings in 90 days. And so then I did a series of 90 meetings in 90 days. It was like I was so desperate to get sober with the food. You know, I just didn't want to be crazy all the time. And it was just, it was really tough. So finally, you know, we, like I said here, we come here with a common problem. The common solution is the 12 steps, the 12 traditions, and becoming, developing a relationship with a power greater than ourselves, whom I could call God. And for me, God stands for good, orderly direction. In my, you know, I had to reconfigure my concept of God because the guy in the chair up in the heavens with the staff that was going, sinner, you're not good enough, no, you know, that wasn't working for me, you know, and that's what my conception of God. It really wasn't even what the church taught me, but that's what my head made it out to be, and I always fell short. I was never good enough. My sister was, but I wasn't. I want to talk a little bit about my plan. I want to talk a little bit about my plan of eating. Like I said, it took me 4 years to get sober with the food. And, you know, I did weighing and measuring. I did all kinds of different, you know, commercial weight loss programs and really was big on weighing and measuring. And finally, after 4 years, my sponsor said, and I have nothing against weighing and measuring. It was really good. It taught me portion control. But I would get to the point where if I ate one pea too many, the two most dangerous words in my vocabulary would come out of my mouth. Fuck it. And then I would be off to the races. And so finally she said to me, and I'd worked through step, probably the 11th step by then. This is, I've been in program for about 4 years. I was going to meetings. I was giving service. I was calling people. I was doing all the things I was supposed to do. And she said, well, maybe you need to change your food plan. Because I was like, no, I've got to do this weigh and measure, you know, commercial plan because this is the way it, you know, this is what it should be. And she goes, well, you know, maybe, you know, no control issues here. but anyway, so she said, why don't you try the 301 plan? 3 meals a day, 0 snacks, 1 day at a time. I can't do that. I'm hypoglycemic. Okay, how about the 331 plan? 3 meals a day, 3 snacks, 1 day at a time. No binge foods. But what if I gain weight? Your weight is none of your business, Tana. Oh. And so I started the 331 plan. And another thing that somebody told me was divide your food up into red light, green light, and yellow light foods. Red light foods are my binge foods. We all know what our binge foods are, don't we? You know, for me, it's recreational sugar. You know, that's a big one. You know, recreational sugar, I had, you know, would be an example of a red light food. Yellow light foods for me were like chips. Maybe I could have a few at a restaurant, but I really got to be careful. It would be nuts, for example, would be yellow light foods. And green light foods were things like lima beans, fish, okra, you know, things like that, you know, various, you know, vegetables that most of us, well, at least I really wasn't too fond of. Also, I had to look at quantities because I was a bag, boxes, and pounds binger. And so it's not only I had to put boundaries. So how I did this, so how I got sober with the food was 331. It was loose enough, so I didn't get into this, oh my God, you know, I would go through periods of being stark, raving, abstinent, you know, and then I would, one tea too many, it would be off to the races. And so by doing the 331 plan, I and the no red light foods, I had to start developing a trust in God. See, I was going to be the God of my food plan, and God could sit aside and maybe give me counsel, you know. I learned the phrase, if God is your co-pilot, you might want to switch seats at that time. And, you know, it's like I amazingly got sober with the food. And I've been sober with the food ever since. Now my red light, green light, yellow light foods have changed. For many years, I couldn't have peanut butter. I was an all-gone eater. A gallon jug, it was all gone. And it was my red light food list for many years. And but now it's like it can sit in the house until it's moldy practically, and I just don't care. It's now green light food. So my foods have changed over the years. And, you know, some things I've had to become more strict with and not have. Like, I don't have diet sodas, for example. It just doesn't work for me. I don't have food artifacts, things that may look and smell and taste like food, but that require a PhD to read the label. That's a food artifact. Doesn't work for me. So, you know, so in some ways my food has gotten narrower, but in some ways it's gotten a lot looser because now nuts are not a problem. Just not a problem. Peanut butter's not a problem. I still go do recreational sugar. In fact, when I go to the doctor, they'll say, okay, Tawn, I know. How much do you smoke? I don't smoke. I haven't smoked since I was in my 20s. How much do you drink? I don't drink at all. What about recreational drugs? It's like, look, I don't drink, I don't smoke, I don't do recreational drugs, and I don't do recreational sugar. Don't take my caffeine away, you know. I do coffee, you know. So, and then they laugh, and they go, recreational sugar? Yeah, it's a problem. So that's my plan of eating. And how I stay sober with the food, you know, if I'm going to get into trouble, if I'm starting to feel hinky with the food, I can call my sponsor. I can text people. When I was new, when I was a kid, you know, besides walking to school, you know, in, you know, 6 feet of snow uphill both directions, we didn't have phone meetings. We didn't have internet meetings. Everything was face to face. And, you know, to this day, I have got to get to at least a face to face meeting every week. I went to 3 to 5 meetings a week for my first 8 years of program. I called my food in every day, my first 8 years of program. I called my food sponsor every day and just usually left it on our phone. But, it, you know, like I said, you know, after getting sober with the food, you know, it took me 4 years. The next 4 years, I wanted to make sure I stayed sober with the food. And so my sponsor would say, well, you know, if this has been working, don't fix it. You know, stick with what works. And they were right. I got my current sponsor and she got me into service. And, you know, I see her things like, service is slimming. And I just think, oh, bite me. You know, it's, I would think, you know, I don't want to call people I don't know. And, you know, why do I have to do this? And, but, you know, my sponsor would say, now I want you to be an intergroup rep. Okay, I'll be an intergroup rep. And so I started, and that's how I did a lot of stints as intergroup rep. And then my current sponsor, and she's been my sponsor for like, over 20 years, I think. Way over 20 years. Anyway, she says, well, she wanted me to, again, be an intergroup rep at this San Jose Northern California intergroup. So I said, okay. And she was, I think she might have been the chair. And then, you know, they needed a world service and region rep. And so I had had, by that time, about 4 years of sobriety with the food, maybe 3 years. I had at least, you know, 7 or 8 years in program. And so I applied for it, and they weren't sure if they were going to have another a World Service Region delegate, because the person who had done it before kind of used it as a vacation and didn't write a report, and they were not happy at all about spending all this money and the person not being really ethical about it. And so I just said, I promise you, if you allow me to go to World Service, I will represent you, and I will go to all the meetings, and I will take good notes, and I will bring you back information. Okay. You know, and so they, you know, I felt like I had this heavy responsibility. So I went to World Service, and I loved every minute of it. It was kind of like intergroup on steroids. But the cool thing about having my sponsor be like the head of intergroup was she knew how to do it in a healthy way. So I got really good healthy modeling and what is a healthy intergroup, how rotation of service is important. And so I went to, and they also said reference committee is where all the action is. So I went to every reference committee meeting. I went to every meeting while I was there, and I took notes. And I came back with 27 pages of notes, single space, both sides. You know, blow by blow, minute by minute. And I was going to get up and do my intergroup report, and Anne said to me, Tawna, you can't do this. It needs to be a page and a half max. That's one piece of paper, front, and half of the back. She goes, nobody else is going to read this but me. And maybe the, you know, some of the other people in the group, this is too much. And I'm like, but you wanted, you know, a thorough report. So they thought that was pretty funny. And I still get teased about this. You know, this is, you know, like over 20 years later. But so I really love doing service at the World Service level and the region level. I got to meet people all over the rooms. And imagine like 300 people in a room, all compulsive overeaters, half of us start raving abstinence. You know, and, you know, but all trying to do the will of OA as a whole and represent our intergroups. It is amazing that anything gets done at World Service, but it gets done, and it is magical. And I loved it. It changed my life. And the things that I learned by being in intergroup and by working with my sponsor and working with not only the steps but the traditions with her have changed my life. And it has just been amazing. So I've talked now, you know, I want to talk a little bit more about how I work my program. One of the things, you know, again, I work with a sponsor. I do service. You know, service is fun. I don't do service because it's swimming. I mean, it's nice if it's swimming, but I do service now because it's fun. I have met the most fun people in OA than I've ever met in my life. You guys are hysterical. See, I keep coming back because you make me laugh. You know, I mean, it's like, if you didn't make me laugh, I probably wouldn't have stuck around, but you guys make me laugh. I have met the people who are my dearest friends in program are people that I would have never mixed with in real life. I mean, we would have just never, you know, we would have just never ever met. And, you know, and they're my dearest friends in the world. They're my closest friends. They are the people that I trust with my life. You know, there's something about hanging out with OA people. We're all trudging the road to recovery. You know, we're all growing in a spiritual path, and we all want each other to succeed. There isn't the bullshit. There isn't the games that you see out in the, quote, normal world. It's just us trying to be better, trying to help each other out. It's my sponsor is kind of like the big sister I never had, and she just kind of like leads me along and gives me a kick in the ass when I need it, which is, you know, relatively often sometimes. You know, working the steps is so important. Working the steps, it's like just going to meetings and expecting to get recovery is not going to get you sober with the food. It's like going to a PTA meeting and expecting to become a parent. There are certain steps you have to go through to become a parent. And going to PTA meetings is not one of them. Just saying. We won't get into the details now. But anyway, so, you know, it's kind of like, so what I had to do is sit down and do the writing. I had to do the reading. I read the big book. They had me work out of the big book. I finally found my big book. I couldn't find it. I'd lost it for a year. And it had all my notes in it, all my highlights, and I was just devastated because I thought, I can't, this is my big book, my original one. My husband found it for me last night. I was so excited. But they had me work the big book. One of the things that, and also not only the steps and the big book, but the traditions. As my sponsor has said, they didn't put the traditions in the OA 12 and 12 to make it twice as thick and charge twice as much money. We worked the traditions like we worked the steps. Really? And that was another thing. There's two things that really absolutely, you know, they talk about in the big book, you know, you get rocketed into the fourth dimension. Two things that did that for me. One was a big book study where we went through the first 164 pages in the big book word for word. And I had to do this when I'd been in program about 5 or 6 years because I didn't get it as a newcomer. It just, it didn't make sense to me. There was too much about alcoholism in there and I couldn't identify. But when we went through the big book, line by line, all of a sudden it just opened my eyes. I thought, oh, wow. That was my first big spiritual awakening. And the second big spiritual awakening is when I went to the traditions and I worked the traditions like I worked the steps. And that was like another big wow moment for me. So kind of what it's like now. I want to do a time check. How are we doing on time here?
8:34.
Okay, so I'm doing okay still, right? Okay, so kind of how I, you know, some of the things that, let me tell you about some of the things that I've done in recovery since getting sober with the food. It's, you know, just because you're sober with the food doesn't mean that life is now wonderful, you know, kittens and rainbows and warm fuzzies and like, yay, you know, happy, happy, joy, joy. No, it doesn't mean that. It means recovery means, and being sober with the food and having that relationship with your higher power means when you go through really crappy stuff, you have a way, it's like your peeps in program and your higher power and your sponsor help you through this. For me, you know, it's like I had trouble with step two. And some of you probably heard me speak before. You know, my sister was the religious one, the very holy one in the family. I was the big sister that was just a, kind of a mean little shit. Sorry, Kara. You know, she was such a good sister, and I was so honored to her. And I had trouble with the higher power concept. And let me have a senior moment here and forget where I was going. But anyway, what I had to learn was I had to develop a relationship with this power greater than me. And for what, it was kind of like the love of OA, and I had to write a want ad, you know, I want God to, you know, walk softly and carry a big stick, you know, if necessarily, beat me over the head with a 2x4, but try to make it obvious so I don't need the 2x4, you know, but if I have to, it's kind of like, give me direction, good, orderly direction. So where do I hear my higher power? My sister would have gotten the burning bush, right? And God spoke, and there's a burning bush and all this stuff. Not me. Being an engineer, I would have had that fire extinguisher out, and I would have had all the equipment, and I would have been putting that bush out like you wouldn't believe. I would have never gotten it was from God. You know, it was like, no, we're going to use technology here. No burning bush, you know. So what I hear from, how I hear God is from every one of you. I don't care if you're a newcomer, or if you're an old timer, or if you're somewhere in between. I hear pearls of wisdom come from everybody's mouth. Good orderly direction. That's my sponsor. When she tells me, after I called long distance, this is before we had cell phones, and spent, you know, $30 talking to her, this happened. What step are you working, Tana? Well, sounds like you're step one with this issue. Damn. You know, and then so we'd walk through the first, you know, four steps and do a fifth step, and then we talk about six and seven, you know. And then I get done and I feel like I was got my butt kicked, and she'd say, aren't you glad you called long distance? You know, and I'd just be thinking, damn it. But, you know, it's like, again, you know, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. I hung on to those words like you wouldn't believe. And when my sponsor asked me to do something, I did it. I might be thinking, thank you very much, you know, but I would do it, and I would growl about it, but I would still do it no matter what. It's just, it's that, again, it's the gift of desperation. So in recovery, this threefold recovery, which is emotional, physical, and spiritual, I've gone through, I found out, well, I was never going to have kids, ever, never. I was a new pet option, not interested in kids, no thank you, you know, just no. And then when I was in recovery for, 12 years, I finally thought, well, maybe I'll have kids. Well, then finally when I decided to have kids, I found out I was infertile and I couldn't have children. And that was pretty sad. And I'm thinking, okay, God, what's the deal here? And so I ended up having IVF with donor egg, and that was really a God thing. And so I went through two life-threatening pregnancies. I had Singleton, my oldest daughter, who was born, and it was in the NICU afterwards because she was born premature. And then I had twins. And they were also born very premature, too much premature, and they were in the NICU as well. And so that, you know, it was like, especially with the twins, it was not knowing if they were going to live or die. And, you know, and then, you know, and going through this, after, you know, it's like, this is still not fair. It's like, I had to use IVF with donor egg. I mean, I just couldn't get pregnant the old-fashioned fun way like everybody else. You know, I mean, and then I had these life-threatening pregnancies and preeclampsia, and that's not fair. And then I had premature kids. And that really sucks. That's not fair, God. You know, but it's, you know, as a dear friend of mine said, you can't really have a good connection with God until you have real honest knockdown, drag out fight with God. And so I had some of those. But when I was, my twins were in the NICU, I had program friends come and be with me while they were in the NICU. And they were so tiny I could hold them in the palm of my hand. 2 pounds, 13 ounces, 3 pounds, 8 ounces. I stayed sober with the food. During IVF. I was told during my twin pregnancy, you have to gain 24 pounds in 24 weeks. Otherwise, if your twins are born early, they may not survive. Do you know how hard that is for a compulsive overeater? Oh, my God. I was sober with the food both pregnancies. I did not eat my red light foods. I did not binge. I did not purge. I was sober with the food. And, after... You know, my now ex started dating the nanny, and that was a whole nother, at any rate, I had to throw him out of the house for getting violent with one of my kids and change the locks on the door, and I filed for divorce, and he would try to break into the house, and it was rather crazy, and you know what? I survived it. I kept sober with the food. I quit my job because I'm a full-time mom. I had to get my job back. You know, 3 months after I quit, I called my boss and said, hey, how you doing? He goes, well, I come back. I said, sure. I went back to work. By this time, I was single parent. I had 2-year-old twins and a 4-year-old. And I was living at 9,000 feet in the Colorado Rockies, and I was sober with the food. And, it's amazing what you can do when you give your will and your life over the care of God, and you can stay sober with the food. And I did it. Somehow, it's magic. I mean, if I could figure out how to bottle up recovery and sell it, I would be a millionaire. But it truly was, you know, as things were really tough. But I did okay. And in spite of all this drama and trauma, I maintained a sense of humor and I laughed a lot. And that's because of OA. That's because of people in these rooms. I had people when I was on bed rest for both pregnancies, for most of the pregnancy, they would come up and do a meeting at my house. They would drive 45 minutes up into the mountain and do a meeting in my house. You know, I mean, the things that people will do in OA to help us stay sober with the food. Then I got divorced and I moved back to Washington State where I grew up, you know, so I can be closer to my family. I found out that my kids had special needs. The twins, we knew they were premature. I found out my oldest daughter had autism, ADHD, sensory processing disorder. It's like, okay, God, WTF? You know, haven't I been through enough? And, you know, and then the twins, they were all, you know, they went through all kinds of speech therapy, occupational therapy, physical therapy, therapy. I mean, it's just like most people took their kids to sports and, you know, basketball and baseball, and we went to therapy, you know, it was just really tough, you know, and my newly married, you know, I got remarried when I moved out here, my husband was kind of like, oh my God, you know, and I'm sure if he would have known the difficulty we went through, he would have never, ever gotten married to me, and I would have never allowed to be married had I known what I was going to put somebody through, because with all the special needs stuff, it was hell. But at one point we separated, and that was a little shock to me because it was like out of the blue, and he just said, I'm gone. And so then again, I stayed sober with the food. I lost a bunch of weight because of stress, you know, but unfortunately it found me, damn it. I really liked being super thin, you know, because of stress, but oh well. Anyway, but we got back together. We're still in marriage counseling. It's like, I will not give that up because I want to make sure that we have our communication issues taken care of. And you know what? Even if you really work on your traditions and your steps and you communicate really well and honestly, if you're married to somebody who's not in program, they have a different communication style. They don't necessarily want to communicate like you do. And for me to try to enlighten him, that was not very successful. It's kind of like going to my dad when I thought he was drinking too much and saying, Dad, you're an alcoholic. You need to read the big book and you need to get an AA. Not very helpful. He never did go. I had to learn to, again, it's practicing these principles in all my affairs. You know, I had to look at things like, you know, tradition. Well, step one, I'm powerless over my husband, my kids, my life, and my life's unmanageable. You know, step two, come to believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. There is a God and it is not me. You know, step three, turning my will and my life over to the care of God. And it's been hard, you know, but it's been okay. You know, it's every time I work through the steps, and I will work through the steps a number of times, I get recovery on another level. It's kind of like you're like in a spiral. And you keep spiraling and keep repeating the steps and the traditions, and you learn more each time. Most recently, a year ago, I became a manager. And let me tell you, if that's not an opportunity to practice these principles in all our affairs, or traditions especially, oh my God. It was really interesting because I had no desire to become a manager. And after being asked for the third time by my manager, who had the audacity to retire, I said, put it this way. I called my dear friend Mike in program in Colorado. I said, Mike, you got to help me out here. And, you know, he just said, well, you know, why don't you ask God? What a concept. You know, it's like, God, you know, how can I be of service to you and my team? You know, thy will be done. If it is your will that I become a manager of the team, I will do that. If it is your will that I stay an individual contributor, I will do that. And so I told my manager, I said, you know, if you think I'm the best person for the job and would like me to apply, I will do that. And if you want me to be the person, I accept. If there is somebody else who is better for the job, please, by all means, pick them. And then Tana steps in. That was the God part. Just do not pick me because I'm a woman, because that would piss me off. Because I'm in a male-dominated field and, you know, I don't want to be the token woman, you know. So anyway, it turns out I got the job. This has been a real interesting opportunity for growth. AFGO, another effing growth opportunity. You know, I get to, tradition one, we talk about our common welfare comes first. Personal recovery depends upon OA unity in the workplace. It is, you know, our group's welfare comes first. Our group's success depends upon team unity. So this is an area where I can be practice tradition one in my meetings, you know, with my staff. You know, for example, looking for respecting everyone's diversity, respecting everyone's differences in learning, differences in performance, their special unique skills, but yet realizing we're all the same. We're all, you know, on this team together, and we got to stick together and help each other out and not fight and become bitchy and backbitey. And it's really interesting, you know, my manager who had the audacity to retire, he would say to me, Tana, you are the best communicator I've ever worked with. And I just think, you want to say this to my husband? He begged to disagree with you. But you know, it's because one of the things I learned in these rooms is how to say what I mean and mean what I say, but not say it meanly. And so I, you know, when I communicate with people, I really try to use these principles in working with these people from, they're all different faiths, they're all from all over the world. I manage a team of, used to be eight, now it's six people, and it's a remote management. You know, they're different parts of the U.S. And so it's really interesting. So not only do you have, you know, different cultural differences and different accents that you got to try to figure out, you have different personalities, and you're doing it all over the phone or via email. So there's plenty of opportunity to piss everybody off. So the program has taught me that is that I can use these principles, and I can open up this 12 steps and 12 traditions, which we're going to do some of, and I can look at these traditions, like tradition one. I can look at things like in the questions. Do we seek to pull together as a group, or are we divisive? Do I discourage gossip in the group? Do I discourage my team from taking each other's inventory? You know, these are things that I can use in my group and use these traditions as guiding principles. And for the newcomers, they might think, what about these steps and principles? Why the heck do I care about this? This just seems really weird. It's because when I finally got sober with the food, I started to figure out it's not what I'm eating, it's what's eating me. And food is but a symptom of a problem, a spiritual hole in my heart. It's this hole in my heart, or this feeling of inadequacy, and I stuff it, those feelings down with food. And when I can get past that, I see that, you know, what I need to do is I need to trust God, I need to work the steps, and I need to use the principles of this program in all my affairs. So it's really helpful to use this as a tool to stay sober with the food. It's those feelings I try to stuff down with food. And these steps and these traditions they're the magic key. They're the tools that I was missing in my toolbox, that I needed so desperately to have in order to be happy, healthy, joyous, and free. By doing the steps and the traditions, I developed a new set of tools so I can live life on life's terms. I can respond with people in a way that's healthy and not have to go binge my brains out after having a strong disagreement with my nemesis, Eric, at work, who is lucky he lives in Columbia, Maryland, because I have a quarter acre of undeveloped land in my backyard. Mm-hmm. And between him and my ex, I have spaces for them, you know. But they are not buried in my backyard because of this program. So anyway, you know, I learned by using these steps and traditions how to live life and respond in such a way so I can be at peace. I know I'm doing the right thing. I know that God is with me, and I know if you're new in program, you might be thinking, oh my God, this woman sounds like a nut. Yeah, I am. surprise, spoiler alert, yes, I am nuts. We are all here because we're not all there. But anyway, so, you know, it's by working these steps, by working the traditions, I have tools so I don't have to live life by binging my way through bags, boxes, and pounds. I don't have to gain 35 pounds every time there's a major, you know, event in my life. I was able to go through my dad passing away sober with the food. And that was one of the most painful things I've ever gone through. You know, I've been able to go through a lot of very traumatic things and be totally sober with the food because of these steps and these traditions and all of you. This is a week program. Any of you think that, you know, 12 steps, 12 weeks, I'm out of here? No. This is not a program that is over and done with in just a short period of time. It takes working the steps and the traditions, and it's continuing to work the steps and the traditions in my life. I'm glad to say now, I only go to a meeting a week typically, and I can do that now. But I know that my first 8 years, I worked my program like a second job. I had to do that. I was a very low bottom compulsive overeater, and I had to do that that's what saved my life. But you know, now it's not like I scared the heck out of this newcomer at a meeting that I was speaking at last Monday. And he comes up to me afterwards and he goes, "You and this other lady said you had to like go to a bunch of meetings a week, and you're in this for like 20 plus years, and you really have to work that hard." And I said, "Well, that's just my experience. You know, everybody's different, but the depth of my compulsive overeating, that's what I had to do." And again, I'm so glad I did it, because you know, one of the things that one of my dear friends has always told me, "Do you want relief or do you want recovery? Going to meetings will get you relief. It's working the steps and the traditions and developing a relationship with your higher power that will give you that recovery, that freedom from compulsive overeating." I live with 3 kids and a husband, and they're all normal eaters. I don't eat recreational sugar. It is all over the freaking house. Every binge food I have is all over the house. I don't touch it. You know, it talks about we recoil from it as if we're, you know, recoiling from a hot flame in the Big Book. It doesn't call to me at all. And my kids, they will eat half a candy bar on the table. That is not normal. Oh, you know, it's like when I see this happening, I'm like, this makes me crazy, you know. And so I get to throw it away, you know. Speaking of, you know, one of the things that I found in program, it was new. This is a tool. It's not published in the OA literature, but this is a tool. Kitty litter is a tool. When I first came into program, you know, it's like, you know, what do you do? So you're in a situation where you know that whatever food X is there, and you're going to get into it. And you know you're going to get into it. And I call my sponsor, like, the cream itself is in the freezer, and I'm afraid I'm going to eat it. She goes, "Take it out and put it in the garbage disposal." "But I don't have a garbage disposal. I'll put it outside the garbage." "No, you won't. You'll go out there and get it later. You're not going to do that." "Damn. Do you have a cat?" "Yeah." "I want you to take that, and I want to mix it with the kitty litter. And then you can throw it out in the garbage." So kitty litter is a tool, because there's no way I'm going to get through that nasty kitty litter and dig out that food. So just saying, no garbage disposal is not an excuse. So anyway, that was kind of an aside there, but you guys needed to hear that tool, right? So, you know, it's, you know, I don't, you know, my kids, there's all this binge food around me, and I am not interested in it. I just don't do it. You know, for years I would not go down, you know, the sweets aisles in the stores. Or if I had to, I would close my eyes walking down the aisle. You know, sometimes it meant I knocked over displays. It was kind of like, oops, you know, but it's like, I finally learned, you know, I don't have to walk down that aisle anymore. You know, so when I shop around the outskirts of the supermarket. That's where all the real food is, not the food artifacts. My husband goes straight to the middle. And so we kind of have an interesting household, because we have, well, not my food, and then we have our food. But, you know, it's like that just shows the power of recovery, because I don't have to eat that food. It doesn't call to me. That is recovery. Having an argument with my husband, we have very quiet arguments. But being able to make up later and not binge over it, that's recovery. I have a coworker. God put him in my life to teach me about boundaries. You know, and he's, you know, I've worked with him for 20 years, and he makes me just as crazy now as he did 20 years ago. And anyway, so I can have quite a heated debate with him on the phone and be really angry. I don't have to call him names. I can stand my ground. I have learned things in program like no is a complete sentence. I don't have to explain why. No. "But I think you should do blah, 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 blah." No. "But blah, 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 blah." No. You know, and just broken record. I've learned phrases from my sponsor like, let me think about it and I'll get back to you. That gives me space. So I don't like say yes because I'm a people pleaser and then eat over it. You know, another thing that I've learned in program, you know, is the phrase, you may be right. You know, if I'm in an argument with a coworker at work, because, you know, in my field, you know, everybody is, you know, we're pig-headed. You know, we're very headstrong, we're very determined, we're very analytical, and we butt heads. You know, and engineers aren't, you know, they're not known for their social skills. You know, so we have some interesting, you know, butting of heads. But I love them. I get along with them. I love what I do. I love my job. Anyway, so, you know, sometimes it's nice when you're having a real heated debate over the phone to say, well, and you know you're not going to get anywhere, just say, well, you may be right. What is not said, and you may be full of crap, but I don't have to say there's thinking words and there's speaking words. I can say, well, you may be right. It diffuses it. I don't have to, you know, totally, you know, go head to head, because sometimes people just need space to think about things, and then we can come back later and talk about it. So those are some of the things and tips that I've learned in program. How are we doing on time here? Okay. So I've talked a little bit about how I used tradition one at work. Tradition two is for a group purpose. There's but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They don't govern. In my work is for my team's purpose. There's but one ultimate authority, a loving God as expressed in our, you know, group discussions. Our leaders are but trusted servants. Or I'm a trusted servant. I do not govern. There is a God and it is not me. So that's an example of how I use, you know, step or tradition two in my work. I'm not God in the group. God is God. And I'm a trusted servant. I'm there to help guide and coach, but I'm not there to, you'll do it this day and you'll like it. Yavol. Now that would have been my family of origin message, you know, the very authoritarian. I've learned a different way to do things. And then finally, tradition three. I'll just touch upon that real quick. You know, the only requirement for OE membership is a desire to stop eating compulsively. In my work situation, or in family, the only requirement for membership in the group is a desire to have a healthy relationship, or is a desire to belong to the team. You know, we are all in it together. You know, as long as people want to be there, they want to work, they want to be in a healthy relationship, it's all good. And this is, you know, these are ways that I can bring my traditions into my job. I would never, ever been able to make it in my job had I not had OA. So I've talked a little bit about, you know, how I got into program, what my program's like, how I work it. You know, I talked about the steps and the traditions and working with a sponsor and going to meetings and many other things. You know, the last thing I want to say is, you know, OA is not a spectator sport. You got to get in and you got to work it. It's kind of like that PTA meeting thing. You don't become a parent by going to PTA meetings. You don't get recovery by just going to OA meetings. It takes work. OA is not a spectator sport. And finally, you know, when I got to go OA, I tried every diet in the planet probably, other than I didn't do stomach stapling and I didn't do hypnosis or the ear thing. You know, I knew it was the last house on the block when I got here. What I had no idea is that it was the best house on the block. And so that's why I keep coming back. Thanks.